I want to draw your attention to a story within a story today. The larger story is that of Gideon, the judge of Israel. You might have heard of him before. Before the kings, beginning with Saul, began to reign over the Israelites, Gideon and other judges led the Israelites. As a matter of fact, God used Gideon and the other judges to lead the Israelites to deliver them from their oppressors, their foreign oppressors. Gideon was the fifth of Israel's judges, and he was raised up to deliver his people from the depredations of the Midianites and their allies. That story is told to us in Judges, the book of Judges, chapter 6, 7, and 8. Chapter 6, verse 1 tells us that the Israelites had suffered 7 years of Midianite oppression. And it was a terrible oppression, so much so that the Israelites even made dens in the mountains and went into the caves to hide themselves from the Midianites who would come in during the harvest season and raise their entire land or destroy the crops of their land. So it was a terrible oppression the Midianites were in, and their allies were imposing upon the Israelites. But it seems like the Israelites were just too weak to rise up against their oppressors until the Lord turned to and used Gideon for that purpose. The Lord, of course, had to help Gideon, if you know the story, overcome his initial fear and timidity. As a matter of fact, the story of Gideon is really a story of overcoming timidity and fear and cowardice. As a matter of fact, Gideon had to be shown 4 signs by the Lord, no less than 4 signs by the Lord, in order to muster up his courage to face the Midianites. But once Gideon had risen up, eventually 32,000 men among the Israelites responded to his call to war. That's in chapter 7, verse 3. Gideon routed the Israelites, or rather I should say the Midianites, in a surprise attack at night with just 300 men. But then other Israelites were summoned to the battle and they joined him in order to complete the defeat of the Midianites. So the Midianites were sent running back across the Jordan River toward the east to their homeland. However, Zeba and Zalmunna, their 2 kings, managed to escape across the Jordan River with a relatively small remnant of their army that remained. Gideon pursued them across the Jordan with just his original 300 men. Now let's look at the story within the story that I want to look at today with you. I don't want to cover the whole story of Midian. I was just giving you some background to help you appreciate this story within a story that I want us to look at. Turn to Judges 8, or listen to me read it at least. Judges 8, beginning with verse 4. Now, at this point, the remnant of the Midianite army, along with their 2 kings, have fled across the Jordan River. Gideon, with his original 300 men, is pursuing them. Beginning with verse 4 of chapter 8 of Judges, we read, "Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came up to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. And he said to the men of Succoth, 'Please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian.' And the leaders of Succoth said, Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands, that we should give bread to your army? And Gideon said, all right. When the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And he went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them. Speaking of a breeze, I've just lost my place. Excuse me for just a moment. Okay. And the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. Let me drop down now to verse 13, because the intervening verses relate Gideon's final defeat of the Midianites. So now he's going to come back, beginning with verse 13, to deal with the citizens of Succoth and Penuel who had refused to help him. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. And he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are weary? And he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and the briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. And he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. So let's go back now and kind of paraphrase what we've just read and try to understand it more precisely. Gideon, after he had crossed over the Jordan River in pursuit of the kings of Midian, was badly in need of provisions for his weary men. And so he stopped at two Israelite cities. Let's not forget that there were some Israelite tribes and people who lived east of the Jordan River. Two of those cities east of the Jordan River, and these were Israelite cities, were Succoth and Penuel. So Gideon asked his own countrymen, fellow Israelites, give me bread for my weary men. But Succoth and Penuel bluntly refused his request. As a matter of fact, the leaders of Succoth curtly replied, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? What were they saying? Well, they were simply saying, listen, the battle's not over yet. You're actually pursuing these men, our enemies. They're not already in your hands. And the implication was, Gideon, you could still lose this battle. And then if you lose it, what's going to happen to us when the Midianites find out that we gave you bread, that we came to your aid? The implication again was, they might suffer Midianite retaliation for giving aid to Gideon and his men. Thus, from a purely political perspective, the people of Succoth thought that it would have been unwise, premature, to commit themselves to Gideon, even if he was their fellow countryman. They wanted to see the contest decided, the battle decided in Gideon's favor before they would do anything to help Gideon. Otherwise, Gideon might lose, and they would have a problem with the Midianites. In fact, Gideon later says in verse 15 that they taunted him with their response and observed that his men were indeed weary. This doesn't seem to be like the group of men, in other words, who would be able to defeat the Midianites. It seemed that Gideon was a fool. He was a fool to continue his pursuit of the Midianites. Actually, from a strictly practical standpoint, the men of Succoth had a point. They had a point. Gideon had only a force of 300 men to attack the Midianites. Now, sure, the Midianites had already been greatly defeated, though not completely defeated. Their forces were massively reduced. I think they had something like 120,000, 135,000 men originally. And the Midianites now were down to, because of their casualties in the earlier portion of the battle, the war, they were down to just 15,000 men. So that's a great, great reduction. But nevertheless, what we've got here is a situation in which Gideon, with just 300 men, is going against 15,000 troops. In other words, the Midianites and their allies still had 50 times as many troops as Gideon. It looked like Gideon was on a suicide mission. I mean, things looked so good for the Midianites at this point. They had already crossed the Jordan River. They had already gone or were on their way home anyway. Looked like the battle was over. They felt pretty secure to the point that Gideon was able to defeat them by another surprise attack. So we might ask ourselves, why were the cities of Succoth and Penuel so disinclined to aid Gideon? Well, there's more than one answer that could be given to that question. For one thing, there might be an explanation in the fact that the Israelites had given themselves to sin and idolatry. As a matter of fact, that's why the Lord had allowed the Midianites to oppress them to begin with. So these were not a faithful people, generally speaking. But also, indications are in this story that they had fallen into a spirit of fear and timidity and cowardice. They were disunified. As a matter of fact, there was one point there at the beginning of chapter 8 when Gideon thought he might have a civil war on his hands, because there were some Israelites who thought he had not properly included them in the battle. Can you imagine that? So the culture of the Israelites at this time was very, very weak from a spiritual and a practical, psychological, and political standpoint. But also, Succoth and Penuel in particular seem to have been too comfortable with what appears to have been their neutrality with the Midianites. Let me observe that the cities of Succoth and Penuel, east of the Jordan River now, were closer to the Midianites than the other Israelites west of the Jordan River were. As a matter of fact, it would probably be safe to say they were neighbors with the Midianites. And so this might have left the citizens of Penuel and Succoth disposed to seek a peaceful kind of coexistence, and probably sought that by compromising with the Midianites and giving them some sort of tribute. This might explain why the city of Succoth had 77 princes and elders. They seem to have had an intact government. They seem to have been prosperous. They seem to have enjoyed freedom of movement. This indicates that perhaps they had effected some sort of compromise or truce with the Midianites, so as to say, oh, we'll give you this if you leave us alone and only attack our brethren west of the Jordan River. Also, let me mention before I move on that Gideon tore down, as he had threatened, the Tower of Penuel. This suggests that perhaps when he confronted the citizens of Penuel with his request for aid, they had responded by saying, listen, we have a strong tower here. You can't hurt us. The Midianites can't hurt us because we're relying upon this tower. Perhaps that is why Gideon said, when I come back, I'm going to tear down that tower. And he did, and killed the men of the city. Well, upon returning from the final defeat of the Israelites, or rather the Midianites, Gideon punished the cowardly citizens of Succoth and Penuel as he said he would do. That's in chapter 8, verses 13 through 17. So now you know where I got the title of the lesson, The Cowards of Succoth. You might have wondered, where is Succoth? I've never heard of Succoth. Well, again, it was an Israelite city east of the Jordan River. And indeed, the men of that city were cowards. They weren't willing to take any sort of risk in order to help their weary countrymen who were pursuing their common enemy. Well, let's consider the application that we can make from this story. The citizens of Succoth and Penuel obviously acted out of considerations of political expediency and practicality rather than principle. In short, if you want to put it in a word, as I already have, they were faithless cowards. Their brothers, who were small in strength and numbers, but great in faith and courage, were trudging off to battle, weary though they were, with a common enemy who had viciously molested their people. Yet when the opportunity for liberty and dignity beckoned, faith did not abound among the citizens of Succoth and Penuel. Their faith should have risen to the occasion. They should have been impelled by their faith to come to the aid of their brethren. All they were asking for was some bread, some food. And yet these cowardly citizens of Succoth and Penuel were governed by fear and self-interest, and they sought the peace and security of evident neutrality with their Midianite neighbors and Amalekites. Because they were satisfied with the status quo, they did not want Gideon coming along and putting them in a position where they would jeopardize what they were enjoying. They did not then want to become involved with the work of God's servant Gideon and his men. Let's make some application from this story to us today. Can there be times when God's people would give in to fear and cowardice? Of course. I will confess to you, there have probably been many times in my life, I will have to say, that I have not been as courageous and as faithful as I should be when I have been prone to back down out of fear of what others might think of me or what might happen to me socially or financially because of what I believe. I suppose that can happen to all of us. And that's really an understatement. Because God's people today can also be cowards in the face of the enemy. Some become so comfortable with the peace they have effected with this world or with false religion that they actually become offended with those who upset their tranquility. Just to give you an example, today I included in the Piscator a story that does not reflect very well on Roman Catholics and their doctrines. There might be some who might think, and I tried not to be unkind about it, I provided an explanation at the bottom of the page, But listen, there might be some who might think, well, you know, he shouldn't have been so blunt. Well, sometimes we have to be blunt with the truth. Listen, if we're going to be faithful to God, it's impossible not to offend some people today. That's just the way it is. The truth is offensive to people. And it's our responsibility to bring the truth to them, whether they're offended or not. Now, that's not to say that we should not exercise wisdom and tact and look for the appropriate time and place and words by which we try to teach people. But the bottom line is that if we're always afraid of the negative reaction of people to the truth we bring to them, then we will never bring the truth to them, and we will not be faithful to God. Instead, again, to be blunt, we will be cowards. Because some Christians are happy with only a facade of faith. Those few brave soldiers who would dare pursue and eradicate the scourge of false doctrine under the banner of truth perhaps get no help from them. Perhaps not even sympathy, not even encouragement from their brethren. Instead, they will say, listen, you need to tone it down. Your rhetoric is too strong. Pick another subject. Don't deal with that. So that's the way they would talk to these preachers of the truth. I've heard of preachers who have been told, you know, you're wrong to even mention the names of false teachers in your preaching and your teaching. So brethren sometimes yearn for what they call positive, uplifting sermons that offend nobody, that condemn nobody, that challenge nobody, that do not deny false doctrine. You know, I'm reminded of the Israelites during Isaiah's day. They had the spirit, I think, of some whom I've just described today. In Isaiah 30, beginning with verse 9, it says, "For this is a rebellious people, false sons, sons who refuse to listen to the instructions of the Lord, who say to the seers, 'You must not see visions,' and to the prophets, 'You must not prophesy to us what is right. Speak to us pleasant words. Prophesy illusions. Get out of the way. Turn aside from the path. Let us hear no more about the Holy One of Israel.'" There's an interesting story along these lines also in the book of the minor prophet Amos. We don't often have occasion to get over to Amos, but we're going to do that right now. Amos was prophesying in Bethel, which was a center of idolatry in the northern kingdom of Israel. And because he spoke the truth there, he upset the idolatrous priest of Bethel. His name was Amaziah. Listen to what Amaziah says to Amos, beginning in verse 10 of Amos, the 7th chapter. "Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent word to Jeroboam, king of Israel, saying, 'Amos has conspired against you in the midst of Israel. The land is unable to endure all his words. For thus says Amos, Jeroboam will die by the sword, and Israel will certainly go from its land into exile.' Then Amaziah said to Amos, 'Go, you seer, flee away from the land of Judah, or to the land of Judah, and there eat bread, and there do your prophesying. But no longer prophesy at Bethel, for it is a sanctuary of the king and a royal residence.'" Now, there is a very interesting expression in verse 12. Amaziah there tells Amos to go to Judah and eat bread. That sounds weird, doesn't it? What does he mean by telling Amos, go down to Judah and eat bread? Well, bread was a staple food for the Israelites at that time. It represented then the entirety of their sustenance, their reward for their labor. So when Amaziah tells Amos to go down to Judah, away from the idolatrous land of Israel, and in particular the idolatrous city of Bethel, he's saying, listen, if you want to make money, if you want to make your living by prophesying, and you're going to be talking like this, then the place you need to do that is not here, but down in Judah. Now, it's natural that Amaziah would speak like that because that's exactly what he was doing. That was his conception of the office of a prophet. The office of a prophet then, at least an idolatrous prophet, was simply to be a propagandist or a cheerleader for the king. You do whatever he wants you to do. You say whatever he wants you to say, no matter how false it is, and you'll be paid for doing that job. In other words, you'll be able to eat bread. So he says to Amos, you do what I do, only you do it away from here. You go down to Judah and do it. Make your living by prophesying there. Finally, along these lines, in 2 Timothy, chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, it says, and Paul is writing here, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth, and will turn aside to myths. So we see from these instances that it is certainly true for God's people to become faithless and cowardly, even to the point that they discourage any faithful preachers and teachers of the truth. Now, we need to bear in mind that cowardice doesn't have to be conspicuous or extreme and obvious. As a matter of fact, it can be downright unrecognizable, even subconscious. We can convince ourselves that we're faithful without really being faithful. In other words, I could say things that in and of themselves are the truth, and people like what I say, but it may not be the truth that people need to hear at that time. But people can say, oh, he's great. He teaches the truth. But really, have I been faithful to my charge if I don't tell people what they need to hear, even if it offends them and makes them angry at me? That's why I say sometimes cowardice can lie under a veneer of truth. Brethren can feel so snug and smug in established traditionalism that any challenges to what they have heard and believed and practiced for so long can make them feel threatened and unsettled. They don't want to re-examine their practices and their beliefs, perhaps, in the light of the scriptures. Rather, their thinking is, we have arrived, and we do not need to hear anything that might be new that we might have overlooked. That's a bad attitude. We should never get to the point where we think, listen, I've learned all the truth that I need the truth. I could not possibly be wrong, or we could not possibly be wrong about anything. That's a bad attitude and can take people to hell. Even preachers then can be capable of cowardice. Many of them might be given too much credit for courage. They might not be aware of how susceptible they are to compromise. Because we preachers are financially dependent upon the brethren, we're really in a weird sort of situation here. Because we have to say things that, as we're prone to say, step on people's toes. But those people are the very ones on whom we're dependent for our livelihood. So there is a great temptation then to try not to offend the brethren too much. And I'm not saying, of course, that we need to be tactless and deliberately offensive. Not by any means. But there are going to be times when it is our job to say things that might, again, as we're prone to say, step on brethren's toes, make them feel uncomfortable. As a matter of fact, it might be said that if I don't make you feel uncomfortable, generally in my preaching, make you feel uncomfortable to some extent, if you don't go away thinking, he said something today that made me think, I'm going to have to rethink what I'm doing or what I'm believing. I'm going to have to restudy this. I need to make some improvements in my life. In order for you to think like that, preachers are going to have to make you feel uncomfortable to some extent. As a matter of fact, let me say this. When I study and prepare sermons, I make myself feel uncomfortable. Reading the scriptures ought to make us want to see our faults, our shortcomings, and want to improve. If that's not the case, then we're not very good Christians. It's our job to strive to improve daily. But again, back to what I was saying. Because preachers are financially dependent upon their brethren, they experience severe economic pressure to conform to what brethren expect of them. Really, it's kind of walking on a tightrope. To a certain extent, we have to strike a balance there. We don't want to be obnoxiously offensive. We want to present the truth in such a way that we can help brethren to improve without repelling them entirely. But at the same time, we can't do that without perhaps exposing ourselves to, or exposing our brethren to offense. There are also socio-psychological pressures on preachers. Maybe I just should say there are also social and psychological pressures on preachers. A pleasant, profitable ministry is often dependent upon cultivating congenial working relations with brethren. Listen, let me tell you as a preacher, it's an awful, awful, awful feeling to know your brethren don't like you, can't stand you. I mean, even if your economic livelihood were not threatened, just to know that people don't like you is an awful feeling. So what's the upshot of that? All of us, and as a matter of fact, this is necessary for all of us to get along with one another in the world. We have to strive to be friendly people. We can't, you know, just constantly go around offending people all the time. It's necessary in order to live in this world, we have to strive to be nice people and to have congenial relations with others. Sometimes what I'm saying, though, is that can be taken so far that it involves us in a compromise of the truth. So all of this disincentivizes, for brethren in general and for preachers in particular, considerations of positions which might stigmatize them and isolate them from the doctrinal mainstream. Is this a problem? Let me give you another example along these lines from the scriptures. In Galatians 2, and let me assure you I'm approaching the end of the lesson. My hands are cold here too. In Galatians, the second chapter, we see that the apostle Peter had gone up to Antioch, where Antioch of Syria was a Gentile church. And this was at a time when the question of whether or not Gentile Christians should be made to conform to the law of Moses was an issue that was not entirely settled in the minds of all brethren. And so here's the Apostle Peter now. The Apostle Peter in this Gentile church in Antioch. And he had been ignoring the fact that Gentile Christians there had not been conforming to the law of Moses. That's the way it should have been. It was all right with him. That was the truth. But notice what happens, beginning with verse 11 of Galatians 2. Now when Cephas, that's Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, that is, let me interject this, that's from Jerusalem, the Jewish brethren. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision, that is, the Jewish brethren, who thought you ought to keep the law of Moses and not eat with Gentiles, even if they're your brethren. Imagine that. But Peter was so fearful of what his Jewish brethren who had come up from Jerusalem to Antioch would think of him that he grew so afraid that he would refuse then to eat with his Gentile brethren, which he'd been customarily doing to that point. But it gets worse in verse 13. And the rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. Now, that's amazing, because Barnabas was the one who had accompanied Paul down to the so-called Jerusalem conference to discuss this very question and had defended the truth with Paul there at that Jerusalem conference. That's recorded for us in Acts 15. But now, later on, Barnabas is so caught up in fear that despite what he had done before, despite his courage before, now he's overwhelmed. Good, generous Barnabas is even overcome with fear. So in verse 14, Paul confronts them about their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, if you, being a Jew, live like the Gentiles and not like the Jews, how is it that you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews? So he confronted even the Apostle Peter for his hypocrisy. In conclusion, then, we must say that those who would enjoy the benefits of truth's triumph must not refuse to commit themselves to battle for it out of fear of siding with those who might be the numerical losers. Listen, we don't have many people here today, do we? This is not a large church. Does that mean then that we're the losers? Folks, if we make it to heaven, we're the winners, regardless of what our numbers here might be. Remember, Gideon only had 300 men facing 15,000 when he crossed the River Jordan to attack the remnants of the Midianite army. So, brethren, today should not straddle the middle ground of neutrality and leave others to decide the issue, so that after the issue has been settled, supposedly, then they can side with the one who is the numerical winner, who has the most, who agree with him. Jesus said, "He who is not with me is against me." If brethren want to serve the cause of truth and salvation, they must give more than lip service to the assertions of love of truth, because cowards will be condemned to hell. I'll close then with this sobering reading of Revelation, the 21st chapter, verse 8. It's a description or delineation of the kinds of people who will go to hell, quite frankly. It says there, but for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death.